From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Lakeside.
The Western Addition.
Diamond Heights.
Emeryville, California.
Westwood Park.
Coming up, we'll get to know the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta's delicate levees, which hold the water back from the farms.
My partner and I were standing right next to the section that broke. And we were out there sandbagging with our workers, trying to, keep it from washing. And we lost.
Then we'll see how filmmakers take our waters to the big screen at this year's San Francisco International Ocean Film Festival.
I think we forget that going out into nature is what really helps us to connect in a very different way.
And we'll meet a young artist trying to find her place as a gay woman in the hip-hop industry.
I kind of feel like being the Ellen DeGeneres of music. Does that make sense?
Cross Currents is next. For the past several weeks, reporter Lisa Morehouse has been bringing us stories from the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. She took us on the route of California's only water-based mail carrier.
I'm out here forever now. I'm never going to leave. I'll never leave this place. To me, this is about as close to God as you can get.
We met a farmer, constantly diversifying his business enterprises.
I love to farm. I like this area. I like to grow things. So if we can figure out how to make money doing something we love to do, then we've got our questions answered.
And a boat captain trying to keep his charter fishing business going strong.
I live on the water, and everybody that lives, all my neighbors are on the water. We're pretty much connected to the water. I'm here because of the river.
But none of those people would live or work in the Delta without the levees that keep the water from flooding the land. In the last installment of our series, Navigating the Delta, reporter Lisa Morehouse introduces us to people whose lives are intimately connected to the Delta's levees.
Mike Scriven is driving a big truck on the levees of an island called Terminus. He's in charge of maintaining the levees here, and that means he's looking for squirrels.
Here's something that we're really watching for is all this squirrel activity that you see here. And there's some fresh diggings right there.
That's a danger sign to Scriven. Squirrels, he says, can burrow into or underneath a levee.
If they go all the way through, then we got water coming through the levee. They're hard workers.
He says animals are a main cause of levee failure. He points out track marks on the levee road.
Okay, you see all these marks in this levee? This is a beaver or an otter.
And if beavers make dens in the levees, water can seep through, weakening the structure. Levees form rims around the islands in the Delta, holding back the water that can be 20 feet higher than the farmland.
If that starts, really getting high water and there's a lot of pressure, then you could have a failure.
That's why Scriven or one of his employees checks these levees every day at least once. If they see a wet spot growing, they dig into the core of the levee to intercept it.
We have material that it's sort of like a gunite that we mix with the dirt and it becomes very hard. And so we dig below where the water is seeping through and then we build it up.
Scriven was elected to a governing board on Terminus. Almost every island has one. Besides inspecting and improving the levees, his job includes maintaining pumps and canals. The work is covered, in part, by money collected from a tax landowners impose on themselves. Scriven says the government provides funding, too, as long as they can show they're improving the levees.
The levee has to be so high, it has to be so wide. You can have this on the levee, you can't have that on the levee. If you don't attempt to reach those standards, you won't receive any funding.
Highways, railroads, and energy and petroleum lines depend on strong levees. Major failures can impact the quality of the Delta's water, which is diverted to much of the state. Scriven says he and his neighbors get most concerned when there's both high water and high wind. He knows what havoc that can wreak from when he was farming Holland Track in the western part of the Delta.
I personally lost a Holland Track in 1980 due to overtopping. And on the day it flooded, I can still remember it, there was very clear, sunny day in February, but the wind was blowing about 40 to 45 miles an hour out of the north.
Over a large body of water next to Holland Tract, causing larger than normal waves.
My partner and I were standing right next to the section that broke, and we were out there sandbagging with our workers, trying to keep it from washing, and we lost. And then the next thing, the whole 2,500-foot section of levee just rolled over, and the water poured in.
He and his partner reclaimed it, draining the island and fixing the levees with government help. He says there have been a few close calls, but never a breach on Terminus. Raising the levees and inspecting and maintaining them with vigilance has a lot to do with that, but Scriven's circumspect.
You got to be lucky.
I head off the island and travel about 15 miles to the town of Rio Vista. I've got an appointment there with Janet Bennett, whose family has a long history in the Delta.
Hi, Lisa. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Bennett welcomes me into a lovely 100-year-old house at the top of a residential street. It's very homey, except for the half-dozen tools called clamshell buckets displayed around the yard. They're huge, some taller than I am. For decades, levees were made from tools like these, attached to dredgers. And this building is the Dutra Museum of Dredging.
My late mother and my stepfather, Edward Dutra, established this residence as a museum in 1980.
Bennett flips through displays of photos and engineering designs of dredgers, hand-drawn on linen.
So this particular dredge that we're looking at is called the Dredge Pearson.
She shows off scale models of dredgers and paintings, including a mural that depicts the Delta's history and physical transformation.
We have to remember that during the gold rush, the population of California ramped up exponentially with people and with animals, and they all had to be fed.
And a process called reclamation began. The state sold what it defined as swampland to farmers who drained it and built levees to create prime farmland. A mostly Chinese labor force built the first levees by hand. Eventually, companies used dredgers and clamshell buckets to move sand and mud from the waterways and build up levees.
The buckets got larger, the booms got larger, and this helped in the reclamation work here in the Delta.
Dredging played a huge role in building the levees, but today, maintenance and repair work looks different. About 40 minutes away on Ringe Tract, three barges sit side by side in the water. The one closest to the levee has a crane attached. The other two are loaded with rock. Project engineer Ryan Abood is overseeing maintenance work on the levee.
First step is to get the quarry stone on the barge.
That happens at a rock quarry in San Rafael.
And then it's towed up by tug to this location. So that's about a 12-hour one-way trip for our tugs. We'll take two flat-deck barges at a time.
Each barge carries about 2,000 tons of this rock, which is called riprap.
That crane barge scoops the rock off of the barges and then swings it over and places it on the levee.
To help prevent erosion. Abood is 37. He was born and raised in the Delta, in the town of Isleton.
You're living on an island, so you're surrounded by levees. So to get to the river, you got to be up on the levees. Growing up, we would just ride our bikes around the island all day long and drink the river. And yeah, it's fun to go out. If you're going to go fishing, you're fishing off a levee. If you're messing around, you're mostly on the river side of the levee system, hiding from,
your parents.
Yeah. We were always out on the boat, water skiing, and just enjoying the Delta.
In his 20s, he got in a pretty bad accident.
I took my 66 Mustang off a levee and rolled it between Rio Vista and Isleton. And then, there's a few friends that lost their lives on the levee systems just, going into the river or head-ons. It's a part of life out here.
Levees weren't just part of the landscape, though. Abood grew up helping fill sandbags during a flood and watching people do maintenance work on the levees for a living.
It was always somewhat romantic for me to watch it. No, not really. it was always around. I always thought that it'd be cool for me to work in the Delta, work on the rivers, and so here I am.
And because of people like him, the levees are still here too, part of the interdependent relationships between the water and the people that make the Delta what it is. In the Delta, I'm Lisa Morehouse for Cross Currents.
That story was the final installment of our series called Navigating the Delta. You can hear the other stories and see photos of the people you just heard from by visiting kalw.org. Just click on Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney. Residents of the California Delta have an intimate relationship with water, but all of us are in some way connected to it.
When I go to the ocean now, I realize that what might be happening to us here locally is probably happening to somebody else halfway around the world as well.
That's Anna Blanco, executive director of the San Francisco International Ocean Film Festival. Now, in its 11th year, the festival will screen over 40 films from more than a dozen countries. Blanco stopped by to give us a preview of this year's program.
The topics are as broad as the ocean itself. What's happening with the marine wildlife, coastal cultures, what's happening as a result of climate change, what methods of fishing are depleting certain species of fish, and where are we going to end up if we don't do something about it. One of my favorite films is a film by Garrett Venn, and it was sent to us from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And this one is called Through the Lens, the Yellow-billed Loon. And it's an amazing bird that is found off the coast of San Francisco. And it has a very distinctive call. It's only 7 minutes, but in 7 minutes you will be mesmerized by the beauty of this bird and the sounds, the beautiful sounds that it makes.
The Channel Islands, a small chain just off the coast of Southern California. These rugged and windswept islands are an oasis.
We also have a film on Friday at 4 o'clock. It's entitled Return Flight. It's the world premiere of a film done by local filmmaker Kevin White. And it's fascinating and it's so beautifully done. It's about the reintroduction of the bald eagle to its native Channel Islands off the waters of Southern California. It is mesmerizing because it talks about the effects of long-band DDT pollution that still persists in the waters and how it's affected the bald eagle.
I was born in the ocean, raised by the waves. The ocean is in me.
This year we're celebrating our third annual student film competition, and the competition is designed to give middle school and high school students a opportunity to do a film, to tell their story about the ocean, and to have it shown on the big screen. One of those is a local student from St. Ignatius College Preparatory School in San Francisco, and it's a beautiful story about how he connects with the ocean through surfing. And it's simple, it tells a story, it just really communicates how he, as an individual, even at a young age of being a high school student, what the ocean does for him when he goes surfing, and how it relaxes him, how he connects with it, and how he feels that the ocean is in him, which is, at the end of the day, true for all of us, I believe.
From a young age, I felt intoxicated by the beauty of the blue. My dad always told me, nobody owes you anything. The same goes for the high seas. You can't control its power, but you can appreciate its beauty.
I think in this day and age with technology, and we all get so all consumed with what we have at our fingertips to make our lives a little bit easier, I think we forget that going out into nature is what really helps us to connect in a very different way, and the ocean is definitely emblematic of that.
Anna Blanco is the executive director of the San Francisco International Ocean Film Festival. Each year, the festival honors a local filmmaker with its Golden Gate Award, and this year, the recipient was filmmaker and surfer Adam Warmington. He spoke with KALW's Martina Castro about the inspiration behind his short film called Sunnydale Kids.
They're shooting gang signs, selling drugs.
It's very scary.
I don't feel like I belong in this type of neighborhood.
Just feels like your head's gonna explode. Feels like that, because it's just mayhem.
My film is called The Sunnydale Kids, and it's basically about taking kids from a at-risk neighborhood in San Francisco surfing for the day. You know, surfing is a leisure activity. You need time for it. You need access and equipment to get to the ocean. It's kind of a little bit of a rich man's game. There's a lot of, you know, white men that surf. And, you know, this film is about taking kids from the Sunnydale neighborhood surfing, letting them play, splash around in the ocean, catch some waves. Like, you know, the one kid you see catch the wave at the end, it's just, you can just tell like how, even retroactively when he's telling you about it, he's just so stoked.
I kind of got water in my nose, a little stinging. I couldn't feel the ground, so I'm like, we turned around, did it again.
So how did you end up in Sunnydale? Like, tell me about that process.
Okay, I'll be as brief as I can. Basically, there's a guy down there, a local shaper, a local surfboard shaper, very well respected in the surfing community, called Tim Gra. And he's a social worker, and he works with the Boys and Girls Club, and he works with the likes of the kids that are in the film. On the other hand, there's a guy called Ian Glover who runs a surf camp for kids in Marin. During the summer, you sign your kid up, they go out surfing every day for a week. So Ian has the infrastructure to take kids surfing and wanted to do some pro bono work, something philanthropic. Reached out to Tim. Tim had the kids, connected the dots, and they started doing it. They started taking kids out from Sunnydale Projects and other organizations surfing in Marin, and they loved it. I got wind of this in talking to Ian and decided to make a short film about it.
I'm curious, sort of, did you said you're a surfer, so did, was it obvious to you that surfing would have this powerful impact on kids?
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, it's such a visceral experience, you know, like any other kind of play. You're like playing with a soccer ball on a field, and you're snowboarding on a mat. This is like one of the only times when you're playing with an element of nature that's moving. You're intersecting with it. The ocean's moving. Every wave is different, and that moment in time is never going to be replicated. And I think that's at the core of why people get kind of hooked on surfing. That those of us that are really hardcore about it, you know, you're chasing those moments, and they're never the same. And so to give kids in general that feeling is great, and then especially kids that don't have potentially as much as much access to being able to do that is massively rewarding. You know, they loved it.
The last wave that I caught, it was so huge. It was like 10 to 15 feet.
I relish working in the short form. I mean, it could have been longer. We could have got granular, more about the issues, and then more about potential solutions, what the layman can do to help out. But, you know, the intention of this was just creating that little moment in time and that beat of a narrative, you know, I think is enough.
That's Adam Warmington, director of Sunnydale Kids, one of the local films featured in the San Francisco International Ocean Film Festival. The festival kicks off tomorrow at the Bay Theater on Pier 39. For more information about how you can jump into the Ocean Film Fest, visit our website, klw.org, click on Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney. And we'll stay near the ocean for our next story. It's in San Francisco's Outer Sunset neighborhood. There's a small building that's a big part of some young people's lives. Sunset Youth Services provides teenagers, transitional-age young adults, and their families with support, like violence prevention programs, parenting classes, and food assistance. And tucked away in a corner upstairs is the youth-run music studio called Upstar Records. That's where teens learn to record their own songs, produce beats, and shoot music videos. 24-year-old Clarissa Bryant has been recording there since she was 16, soon after she came out at school. KALW's Audrey Dilling brings you the story in this installment of Bay Area Beats.
My name is, well, my government name is Clarissa Bryant, and my music name is Reese's. Flash Beats. I grew up actually in the Castro district with my two grandparents, so my grandma, my grandpa, my mom, my older brother. I only have one older brother, and my two cousins. I'm half Filipino and I'm half African-American, but I was raised on my Filipino side. I didn't really know my dad. He wasn't there.
She got a lot of pain deep in her heart, but I ain't never met a girl who could put me in shock. Let's take a walk straight down memory lane, because I remember a few things that I couldn't explain.
When I started doing music, I was in middle school, We were doing poetry classes. Poetry was different. It was more based on hip-hop and music. So from there, I just started making music because I used to sing along and mimic everything. Like The Lion King when I was little, I used to sing that over and over again. I'm gonna be a mighty king, so enemies beware. Well, I've never seen a king or beast with quite so little hair. I'll never forget the first time I sung, and my cousin just looked at me and she was like, "Hey, do that again." Like, and I did it, and she was like, "She could sing." And from then, I didn't really have a chance to, like, to record anywhere until I came to Sunset Youth Services.
Yo, this that yo. Immaculate. Never see magnificent, articulate imprisonment. So now I gotta break free. Fly high, I see Macy's cheesecake and some pastries. Nike at Hardy's, see all I see is greed. No happy.
The first song I recorded here was, well, I don't remember what it's called, but I know how it goes. It's like, I know you're looking down on me. I can't sleep cause you're always in my dreams. I try to be happy cause I know you're free. But you're holding me down and it's so hard to breathe. Breathe! That was the name of the song. Yeah, that's what it was. That's actually about my grandparents. And it was about, well, they passed away my 8th grade year. Like, they didn't get to see me graduate. So that was, like, a hard time for me. I started doing music around, like, actually recording it around 16. But I was writing, like, I would start writing just, like, crazy in between because I never had an outlet. I came out when I was 15, my beginning of my sophomore year. I was so trapped and stuck, and I just couldn't be myself, even though I was acting like myself. It just was like I had spandex on and leather pants over that, and it was hella tight. Like, I needed to get out of that. It was sweaty, and it was stuck on while I was trying to get it off. It still was, like, there. And as soon as I got it off, it was like, oh, my gosh. Like, I felt so great. Like, I don't know. When I came out, I felt like half of my body weight was off of my shoulder. What's going on, man? Wait a second. Send a message. Change your font. Start to trot. I don't know. My pads unlocked. My sandals fly. Like, that was me speaking to, like, rappers or people in general in the industry that just send this one message, like, about cars and money and girls and all that stuff. And it's just like, that's not what it's only about. I kind of feel like being the Ellen DeGeneres of music. Does that make sense? Like, me being gay is just like a brush. You know what I mean? Like, just like how Ellen is just like, oh, like, she's gay, cool. Like, I want to be that one person that's like, oh, she's super cool. You know she's gay, right?
Find links to more music from Clarissa Bryant and Upstart artists at KALW.org. And that's it for today's show. Our team includes Julie Kane, Jen Cheehan, Nina Ginsler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Stephen Short, Raisu Sussman, and Melanie Young. Today's show is produced by Leela Day and engineered by Seth Samuel. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Holly Kernan is our news director. And because of your support, we can proudly say we are listener-supported public radio. The music you're hearing now is the sound that predated rock and roll and helped start the concept of Top 40 Radio. It's called Rhythm and Blues Dance Music, or JUMP, and it's being played by the Stompy Jones Band of San Francisco. Stompy Jones plays every week at the Tuesday Night JUMP, held at the Verity Club in San Francisco. The music starts at 9:40 p.m., and there's a two-hour dance lesson that starts 2 hours before it. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney. Enchanted fools pretend.
will soon fade. And I will walk in this ancient headland.